From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
What are our vegetable garden pests trying to tell us, and how can we move past the mindset of it being all about us against them and knee-jerk interventions with some so-called remedy every time they show up? That's just one of the attitude-adjusting insights I want to talk about today with organic farming and gardening champion Elliot Coleman, whose 30th anniversary edition of The New Organic Grower is just out. But first, this message.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
Elliot Coleman has written extensively about organic agriculture since 1975. He has more than 50 years' experience in all aspects of the subject and has been a commercial market gardener, the director of research projects, a designer of tools for farmers and gardeners, and a teacher and lecturer. He and his wife, Barbara Damrosch, operate Four Seasons Farm, a commercial year-round market garden in Maine. And welcome to the program. I'm so glad to speak to you, and congratulations on the 30th anniversary edition.
Oh, thank you very much, Margaret. Yeah. It's fun to bring it up to date.
Yeah, a lot has changed, and then on the other hand, the fundamentals are still the same. the approach, I guess.
We're always learning new things.
Yeah.
It was great to put all that together.
And, yeah.
Add that to what was originally written back in 1988.
I'm old enough to have a copy of the original edition here on my bookshelf, along with books by Helen and Scott Nearing and John Jevons and Alan Chadwick and other people that I've admired a long time and been inspired by. So it has a nice place in my home, the original and the new one. Yeah. So though the book is about organic agriculture, about farming, and it's for farmers mostly, it's really loaded with insights that we gardeners, like my listeners and readers, can apply in our smaller undertakings in the backyard. You know, things like soil blocking as a tactic for doing seedlings, and a new chapter in this edition that Barbara I think contributed about flowers as part of the overall planting plan, or the use of minerals and organic matter to improve infertile soils. So, like, what are some of the things that you updated the most or the least, or kind of what's new and old in it?
Well, one thing that gardeners and farmers are always working on are finding more efficient ways of doing what they're doing.
Mm.
So they get to eat well with less work. And so one of our favorite activities is designing and then finding some way to get somebody to produce tools.
Yes.
That help the small farmer or gardener do what they're doing better. And I always tell people, when I started back in 1965, I mean, we were almost like we were in the 19th century, because no one had been focusing on tools for the small market farm, large home garden,
yeah,
anymore. And all of the tools were pretty crude. And so the nice thing, we've been able to come up with a good set of tools that make life easier and things more efficient, and that we're no longer in the 19th century, pleasant as that may have been.
So that would be things like, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, although I have one, the collinear hoe, would that be one?
Yeah, a better hoe, you use it standing upright rather than bending over and chopping it.
Yes.
70-degree angle between the blade and the handle. And as I tell everybody, the nice thing about the position in which you use this hoe, if you think about it for a minute, it's actually the ballroom dancing position. So something you do voluntarily.
Uh-huh. And the broad fork, would that be another one that you've kind of improved?
Yes. The broad fork was actually thought up by a small French farmer,
mm-hmm,
back in the 70s, and copies of it have been around for a long time. But as an idea that allows you to take care of any compaction in your soil underneath the surface without turning everything over totally.
Right. I mentioned soil blocking, and I loved that section because every year I swear that I'm going to move past either open flats or salt packs, you know, in a flat, and I'm going to block soil. So tell us just a little bit, is that what you do at Four Season Farm? Is that one of your primary tactics?
Yes. Well, years ago when I started, like everybody else, before any of these new ideas were common, yes, we just used regular open flats with soil in them and spaced the seedlings, and then when they were ready to go to the garden or to the field, we would cut them out in cubes the same way if we were cutting brownies out of a tray in the kitchen. And the nice thing about soil blocks is if you get the potting soil to the proper moisture level, you're pressing the potting soil into little cubes with a hole in the top,
right,
depression in which you can drop a seed. The nice thing about it is that there is a slight division between the blocks because of the edges of the block form. And when the plant's roots grow to the edge of the block, they pause there so they don't go out into that slight air opening.
Right.
And, boy, when you put these in the ground, all of a sudden they have soil on all sides and they take off much faster than some plant that was in some little container and its roots began to circle around.
Mm-hmm. So one of the other things, not tool exactly, but tactic, you say in the new edition and maybe even in the old edition of the book, The New Organic Grower, the things that turn an infertile soil into a fertile soil are minerals and organic matter. And that shouldn't be such a big aha, and yet people still want bagged fertilizer, you know. They're still looking for the instant fix.
Yes, I think. And that's one of the things that I always mention to people, is really the difference between what a farm does and what a garden does. A garden can afford to pay extra money for soybean meal or bone meal. But on the farm scale, that isn't possible. So the farmers, and if you are a farmer, you've learned this, are more concerned with finding whatever sources of organic matter are available in their neighborhood, and then composting them, and then that becomes the basis for the soil fertility program of the farm.
Right.
And the same would be true of a garden. So I always tell home gardeners, make as much compost as you can. I've known people who always, when they drove around, always had a couple of empty garbage cans in the back of their car. And they'd see somebody about to throw out leaves or something like that, and they'd squeal to the hall and ask if they could have them. And people were always happy to find a use for organic matter.
Yes. So what I got from the book most of all this time around, and I sort of alluded to this or referred to it in the intro a little bit, reading the new edition, was really the mindset. It really sunk in this time. The way you kind of turn things on their head and shake up our thinking or hope to. And some of the quotes that I'll just say, and then you can tell us more about this, like, for instance, cultivate ease and order, not battling disease and disorder as an approach, or that we need to reset our pest negative thinking. So can we talk a little bit about order as opposed to disorder and pest positive thinking?
Sure, yeah. Ever since I got into this game, I realized that if I wanted to make a living and be happy and be doing good work, the idea of spending all my time concerned about which horrible poison I was going to use on the insects was just going to ruin everything. So that was the first reason when I decided to become a farmer, I wanted to be an organic farmer, because it seemed like, okay, that was one piece of thinking that was along the right direction. And it isn't that an organic farmer or organic gardener is not using pesticides. They are not needing pesticides. And if you don't need it, why use it?
Mm-hmm.
So how does that happen? Well, there is an enormous amount of information in the published literature in entomological journals indicating that when plants are put together correctly, and by that I mean they're growing in a soil that provides them with all the minerals and nutrients they need, that the protection comes from what scientists call induced resistance, that all of those wonderful little microorganisms that live in the soil, especially if you put plenty of organic matter in there, and live around the roots of the plant, there are actually activities going on that seem almost miraculous when you read about it, that strengthen the plant vis-a-vis its resistance against pests and diseases.
Yeah, I mean, in the book you say organic agriculture is constrained by an imitative kind of thinking that merely substitutes organic inputs for chemical inputs, you know. So that's like the farmer or the gardener is accepting that old framework of conventional farming or farming with chemicals, always looking to like shake something on, like, you know, putting salt on your dinner to make it a little saltier, which, you know, is not what we should be doing in farming and gardening.
Oh, yeah, no, and the key to all of this is to understand that the natural world is the most elegantly designed operation I've ever encountered, and that working with it, trying to figure out which direction it wants to go and how my activities in the garden can aid in creating the fertility, aid in creating a stronger plant, and then use the techniques that lead in that direction.
So aiding in it, you mentioned compost, as we always say, make as much as you can and use it. But and with the minerals, the rock dusts, is there, what do? Do we get a soil test? If we're home gardeners, again, you know, not on the large scale necessarily, do we start with a soil test to get, to draw inferences on what we need to add?
Yes, but very often. If you read some of the material that was coming out in the early 20th century from extension services and places like that, they explain that in most normal soils, there is a great deal of potassium, a great deal of minerals mm-hmm. in the top, what they refer to as the acre furrow slice, and that's the top 6 2/3 inches of an acre. And that is an enormous amount of soil, and there are an enormous amount of nutrients in there. What makes those nutrients available is all the activities of the microorganisms in the soil that then create conditions so the roots of the plant can access those minerals there. And in many soils, as long as you're putting in plenty of organic matter, and if it's coming from off your garden, off the farm, it's bringing in minerals in itself from elsewhere, you almost don't need to go out and buy a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
For example, here on our farm, we basically don't purchase any of those inputs that people would be thinking about
right.
because we're continually working on growing the fertility in place with cover crops, green manures, and so forth.
Right. I mean, I have to say, even just being in the same place for 30-something years as I have been in my garden and being an organic gardener that whole time, you know, and people constantly write to me and neighbors say to me, or people when they come for open day garden tours, they say, well, what do you do about this and what do you do about that? You know, all these pests that they're talking about. And you know, like, I hate Japanese beetles too, but generally speaking, I don't have anything that ever takes over an entire area or crop or, you know, any kind of real disaster going on. And I feel like that's the payoff from having been soil focused for all those years, like always following. And again, the books on my shelf were the ones I mentioned before from people such as yourself, always focusing on feeding the soil, taking care of the soil, adding back my composted debris, you know, turning it into something great, and really protecting the soil. I feel like that it makes such an enormous difference. And yet again, I think many people still look for that instant, quick remedy thing mentality.
Yeah, well, I think we're encouraged in the world we live in to look for instant, quick remedies because there's somebody out there usually trying to sell it. Japanese beetles, interestingly enough, only made it way up here to Maine a few years ago. And so I was trying to figure out what I could do about it. And so I went to the shop. And I got a long extension cord and took the shop vac out where the Japanese beetles had showed up on the grapes. And I put the fine nozzle on the end, and it was like magic. I was going along, and I used to refer to it as going... and they're disappearing down the nozzle. But the wonderful thing about it was when you think of all the problems that are created for gardeners and farmers because insects eventually become resistant
yes.
to the poisonous pesticides they're
yes.
using. Well, I realized that it was probably impossible for insects to become resistant to to vacuum.
To shop vacs, yes. Well, I find I'm pretty fierce with the old-fashioned jar of water, soapy water or just water, and early in the morning when they're still lazy, knocking them into that and drowning them.
Yes.
They're pretty. They have not co-evolved with my strategy to knock them into the water and drown them either, and they have not advanced. So, so in the book, in the New Organic Grower, you talk about that we need to reset our pest negative thinking, and really, there's this wonderful part where you talk about pests as messengers about our cultural practices, that they actually have information to give us. Can you tell me a little about that?
Well, actually, the original line came from Sir Albert Howard, the British scientist who wrote the earlier books on organic farming. And the line he wrote was that insects are the best professors of agriculture because by their presence, they will tell us that we are doing something wrong. That is, the insects that eat crops. And basically, they're bringing you a message that conditions in your garden are not as good as they could be for all of those crops. And if you kill the insect, you're basically shooting the messenger. When we've learned to listen and try and figure, okay, what did we not do right this time? Is it the soil too compacted? Did we use the wrong compost, it wasn't mature enough. And we'll usually find that if we investigate it, and basically it's whether you want to correct the cause of the problem or just treat the symptom. And insects are a symptom that there's something wrong with the growing conditions in your garden. And if you use pesticides, you're treating the symptom. If you try and make those growing conditions better, you're correcting the cause.
I love that you confessed to flea beetles having the upper hand, because I think where I garden, and I have many organic farm neighbors in my town. It's an old agricultural town, and lots of young great farmers have moved in. And the flea beetles are what we all talk about. Like, none of us can figure out the flea beetles.
Well, it's interesting. I got had a wonderful visit from a farmer far away from here, but on a clay soil, who was visiting once, and he said, "Oh, what's all those sheets of fabric out there?" And I said, "Well, if we don't cover the certain young greens, especially the cabbage family, the flea beetles can cause trouble." And he said, "Golly, I don't have any trouble at all with flea beetles."
Oh,
so it could be, and that's what I suspect, and I said in the book, that we have such a light, sandy soil that under these conditions, it is harder to make peace with the flea beetle than with any other pest we've ever seen. And most of the pests have just disappeared. But when the conditions are right for the flea beetles, they're there, and that's why some sort of floating row cover is a very efficient solution under those conditions.
And that goes on at sowing time?
Right after you put the seeds in the ground,
yeah.
We just put hoops over the bed and stretch some floating row cover and drop some sandbags on the edges to hold it down.
That's interesting that you say that it's a fast-draining soil, because in the town center farm that I'm talking about, a couple of hundred acres that a lot of friends farm there organically, it is that type of soil. So that is indeed flea beetle central for us where I live.
Yes.
Yeah. Interesting. So they are trying to tell us something. So kind of other, you know, indicators, some other pests that, you know, are giving you an aha, are there any? I mean, people are frequently irate about the appearance of some of the cucurbit pests, like squash bugs, for instance, cucumber beetles. I mean,
yeah, there was a wonderful story about squash bugs and cucumber beetles in a research paper. And it turned out that it was trace elements that made the plant more resistant. In fact, the thing they were recommending was to use dried seaweed as a fertilizer. And we have done that since I read that, and it's just fantastic how effective that is on strengthening your cucumbers and your squash plants.
Oh,
now,
interesting.
One other thing to mention there. One of the things about the cucumber squash family is that they do not take kindly to transplanting.
And no.
If you have grown transplants in order to get an early start, you really need to protect them with some sort of a mesh or fabric cover for the first couple of weeks after you put them in the ground so they can get established. And one of the best theories on the relation between plants and insects is the plant stress hypothesis. And this hypothesizes that insects can only gain an upper hand when the plant is under stress through inadequate growing conditions or having been transplanted and not having time to get its systems back together.
Mm.
So protect your cucumber and squash seedlings for the first couple of weeks after you put them in the ground, and that'll usually make a pretty good improvement. And if that doesn't work, get some dried seaweed. I always found that to be one of the best.
When all else fails, go for the dried seaweed.
Yes, yes. Or, and here's the other thing. Another thing I've noticed ever since the start, because when I have been gardening in different parts of New England, I have occasionally been near a horse farm and was able to get horse manure. And
yes.
All of the old books on market gardening back in the 18th century, you'll find throughout that they say the only fertilizer that really works for vegetables is horse manure.
Huh.
And this surprises a lot of people. But even better than horse manure where the bedding under the horses was
yes.
straw rather
yes.
than sawdust or wood shavings. And the combination of horse manure and straw for, 150 years or more, has been considered to be the absolute best fertilizer for vegetables. So if you have a neighbor with a horse, see if you can't make a deal with them to give them some straw for bedding. And,
agreed, yeah. Volunteer to muck out the stalls in return for the goodies, right?
You got it.
Well, Elliot Coleman, I'm so happy to speak to you, and congratulations again on the 30th anniversary edition of the New Organic Grower. I'm very pleased to have it, and we're going to have a book giveaway, of course, for people, and I'll give information about that on the transcript on the website. So thank you.
Great, and thank you very much. It's been a delight, Margaret.
Okay.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
Thanks to all of you for listening to, and don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. You can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on Instagram and Facebook at awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.